things that we notice about certain judges is certain judges get a lot more page than others. And there's a lot more that goes on. And really, if you take the time to stop and dig into every detail, you'll see that Gideon's maybe one of the, yes, the most action-packed, but there's a lot of details in there of things that you and I struggle. 7 verse 9 gives us this, "And it came to pass the same night that the Lord said unto him, Arise, get thee down unto the host, for I have delivered it unto thine hand. But if thou fear to go down, go thou with Purah thy servant down to the host. And thou shalt hear what they say, and afterwards shall thine hands be strengthened to go down unto the host. Then went he down with Purah his servant unto the outside of the armed men that were in the host. And the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the children of the east lay along in the valley like grasshoppers for multitude, and their camels were without number as the sand by the seaside for multitude. And when Gideon was come, behold, there was a man that told a dream unto his fellow, and said, Behold, I dreamed a dream, and lo, a cake of barley bread tumbled into the host of Midian, and came unto a tent, and smote it that it fell, and overturned it, that the tent lay along. And his fellow answered and said, This is nothing else save the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel, for into his hand hath God delivered Midian and all the host." We understand from our studies that the art of Christian warfare looks different and works differently than that of this world's. The world debates. They use cunning phrases to convince one way or the other. All over the world today, lawyers stood before juries defending clients they knew for a fact were guilty. We lie, we shout, we spread rumors. We even go to war to gain superiority over everyone else. This system, I would declare, is a broken one, where one man, through cunning linguistics or sharper knives, attempts to assert his opinion as truth, as though truth can be so subjective, it can be won in a card game. It submits that truth is determined by the strongest, or, as Winston Churchill said, history is written by the victors. Had the war he was in gone the other way, we would have completely different heroes indeed. That is the battle that we see going on right now. Convince the masses, weaponize the school system, create a scapegoat, punish the scapegoat, and execute the opposition. If you look through history, you'll see time and time again, when we enter into a dictatorship type perspective, right? There's different names that society would put onto it, but we're entering into a tyranny. What do we see when we see a tyranny? Well, we see exactly what we're seeing now and exactly what we saw during Hitler's rise to power. Number one, we need to convince people that our opinion is right. Convince them that, number one, they are victimized. Do we not see that today? Everyone is victimized. Everyone is hurt. I was watching on the news, and I see one of the gymnastics bailed out. Now, if you look at the conversation around it, why are they saying in the mass media why she bailed out? Mental health. You look directly at her quote. You know what she says? My mind's not into this right now. I've got to stop and focus on me for a second. She didn't say that she was struggling from depression, anxiety, frustration, none of those things. Just, you know what, I made a mistake, and clearly that means my head's not into it, so I'm going to take a week off. Now, honestly, I could really care less about people in sports and what they're doing. I'm all for Team America, just like most of you guys are. I'm just all for it. But what do we see there? The same thing that we're teaching these young people. You are a victim to your own mind. You're a victim to everyone around you. You are struggling. You are at an adverse effect. Now, why? Why are we teaching them this? Well, for the most part, so the government can swoop in and be the hero. And you'll see that. Pay close attention. The government both plays the bad guy and the hero. Because of the government, you are oppressed. You don't have enough money. You can't afford this and you can't do that because of a systematic error in the way government is run. Now, what's going to fix us? Voting the proper people into office and the government will save us. And if you really pay attention to what Hitler did, what Mussolini did, what is often played out in Middle Eastern countries, this is exactly what they do. they come in with food and they come in with promises of a better future. And they say, well, you know what? This government or this society has always hurt me according to you. And look at you. You're so sweet. You're so nice. You promise me a better future. You put food in my belly. Therefore, you must be good. They use these lies. They force propaganda. Sometimes they just go to straight violence to accomplish their way and will. And this is not the way we are commanded to make war as Christians. 2 Corinthians 10:2, jumping into the middle of a conversation Paul is having, says, "But I beseech you that I may not be bold when I am present with that confidence wherewith I think to be bold against some. Which think of us as if we walked according to the flesh. For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. And having in a readiness to revenge all disobedience when your obedience is fulfilled." Here we see Paul having to deal with some ordinary sinners at the church of Corinth. He used these words to clarify and to educate some misconceptions. This would also go as a warning to those in the church that were causing trouble with their false doctrine and their sin. We are too used to the fruit of the Spirit. We're to use the fruit of the Spirit, love, mercy, and the gospel, having a ready answer and all of Scripture to go into battle with. We even have the full armor of God to wear in order to protect us. Not lies, not cheating, not coerciveness. Again, we look at some of these more business-type churches out there. What are they doing to bring people in? Right? When you get to the point where you can't tell the difference between a sale at a mattress warehouse and an introduction or invitation to a church, you've got a problem. And that's what we have. I was reading one thing and I just kind of had to shake my head. They're saying, you know, your church looks like every other church out there. What will really catch their attention is if you just put balloons at the entrance. Have you ever done that, Sister Glenda? You ever been driving? Balloons? I've never done that. I'll pass used car dealerships like they. You know, we used to do that in the apartment industry for that same reason. And you want to know why I would put myself in my vehicle with a trunk full of helium-filled balloons? Because I was selling something. And I wanted to catch people's attention. Here in these four walls, I'm not selling anything. We're preaching the truth. And the truth doesn't need the bells and the whistle. The truth does not need gimmicks and fakery. We don't need to trick people into the gospel. Because what will eventually happen is if you trick a sinner into the gospel, they'll eventually catch wise and sit there and they'll accuse you of things. That's why, again, we talk to people, "Well, when I went to church, this happened and that happened." I don't want to be the reason for that. If the gospel can't keep you here, nothing will. At least nothing that we're going to attempt to do will. And there's no point in it. We're not called to fight that way. We're not called to deal with each other in that way. To where, you know, Danielle and I were getting into an argument, so I go over and I get Brother Art and I get Brother Bill, and we're all talking together, and listen, my wife this and my wife that, and they go, "Good on you, boys." And she goes over and she's talking to their wives, and all of a sudden all three of us are in the same fight. We're not called to do that. I've often made that point where in churches we don't settle our debates like we would be picking teams for a kiddie sport event like dodgeball. "Well, whose side are you on?" "Really? We're doing this? You know what? I'm on the Lord's side." "Well, what's my side?" "Yeah, everybody says that. Sit down. Get yourself together." It was the Civil War. You know, both sides of the Civil War firmly believed that God was on their side. And you sit there and you go, "Well, you guys need to get together and talk that out. You'll develop some kind of like some kind of custody system over the Lord, because you can't both have him and be shedding blood like that." Now, we do know this, that we are to fight, but in God's way. See, God decimated, I mean just destroyed, the numbers here that Gideon had. He walked in, this scaredy cat Gideon, not to pick on him, I get scared too, but walked in with 32,000 people. And now he's standing around and only 300 are left. Why? So that God could prove his strength. And now we've got to change the way we do this war to prove that God's way is the only way that's going to work. You can't take 300 against a number like that. You know, I tell you what, I think God wanted Gideon to go down there. Number one, yes, for validation, and yes, to deal with this fear. Aren't you glad that God knows who you are when he calls you to do stuff? He looks at you, he knows you, he acknowledges what you need, he knows the deficits and what you're able to do. But I also think it's important for Gideon and Purah to have looked around and saw the sheer amount of numbers that God was about to put into their hands. Now, from a human perspective, that's a big, scary number, right? How am I supposed to do this? And nonetheless, you and I, we face those same battles. How can I fight this sin? How can I fight this thing going on in my extended family? How do I fight this thing going on in society today? How do I stand up and fight a good warfare? Because as 1 Timothy 1:18 says, this charge I commit unto thee, son Timothy, according to the prophecies which went before on thee, that thou by them mightest war a good warfare. We take the things that God has told us and we put them into practice. Consistent practice. There's absolutely nothing worse than inconsistent obedience to the Lord. God had a lesson he was about to teach, and it's important for us to pick it up. Point number one, we see what he shows them here is the dream. Now, I absolutely love, I love what happens here. He goes, all right, go down there, and I'm going to reveal to you my victory, okay? And he goes down, like, Purah, come on, Purah, let's go. And they go down there, and they just see two guys talk. You know how two guys talk? And in my head, I don't like to take license with the Bible, but my head, one guy woke up, and he's just kind of sitting there by the fire. Another guy comes up to him, hey, man, what's wrong? Man, I just had the craziest dream. I was sitting there in this big old barley bread came down, knocked a tent over to where it was on its side, almost upside down. Craziest thing. And the other guy goes, well, surely that's the sword of Gideon. And you just kind of think about that kind of conversation. Now, was the second guy being sarcastic? Did the Lord give him some revelation there? I don't know where he got the interpretation of this dream. All I know is that they were saying what they were supposed to be saying because God ordained it. They ordained that he'd be up and he'd be there. And then here, at the same time, Gideon and Purah made it in, sneaky was kind of coming up into there. This is what they would hear. And again, we've talked about this, how God can do that, how God puts us in the right time, in the right moment, to do the right thing. And how it's important for us to recognize God's hand in these things. To not try to take any glory from it or to give blame to coincidence. But God worked this out to where the guy would have the meaning of the dream, the guy would have the dream, and here would be the people who are really supposed to hear it. Now, it's good for us to notice, too, that these two guys talking back and forth about the dream wasn't for them. Now, how do I say, well, how do I know that? Because these guys weren't going to last the night. Right? These guys weren't going to make it. When we're looking at this, the whole point of the dream here is we see an uncertain enemy. And in many cases, when we contend with this earth, it's important for us to remember that we're fighting an uncertain enemy. An enemy that is so mixed up in its humanistic and false religion philosophies that it has no certainty itself. You talk to people, many of them have no idea. It's become so often that you've run into people who have a little bit of Christianity, a little bit of spiritualism, a little bit of humanism. I believe in God, but not so much what he has to say. I'll sit there and I'll follow my horoscope and the tarot cards. But at the same time, if I find out that somebody else is doing something against the Bible, I'll gossip about them. There's a pluralism that has invaded our society and it has invaded our culture. And we need to be aware of it. Now, through all of this mixing together, now if we were to look at a history of humanism, which I'd really like to do one day, but if we looked at a history of it, one of the side effects of listing mankind, our philosophy as God, whether we acknowledge it or not, one of them is a thing that came out with Friedrich Nietzsche, and that was nihilism. Nihilism postulates that absolutely nothing matters. That I could try my best and it really won't make any difference. I can live a perfect life to no merit. I can live a horrible life to no merit. Nothing matters. Nothing is sensible, and it is the most depressing thing you could ever study. And it is a philosophy that is being taught, where people embrace this philosophy. And they say, well, it's not super pessimism, but it is super pessimism. It doesn't matter. If I do this, this will happen. I can live a perfectly healthy, clean life. I can eat my fruits and my vegetables. I can follow all the diets that the doctors give me and still get hit by a bus. And these guys get excited about this because it frees them, in their mind, it frees them from responsibility. Right, I no longer have to say that my actions or the actions of others have any long-term consequences. And if anything bad happens, I can just blame it on what is going on around me. Again, a huge chunk of what is being taught without being said. In the public school system, in the college system, this is a big part of the philosophy that they push. Nothing matters. There are no real consequences. Another side effect is hedonism. Now, if nihilism says nothing matters, hedonism says only pleasure matters. Does it make me feel good? Does it make me seem that, do I feel like this is right? And again, this is a huge part of what's also being taught. This hedonism, this idea of if it feels good, do it, which is why we talk about things like it's wrong to shame people for their proclivities, their promiscuous lifestyles. As a matter of fact, it's not shaming. I'm saying that it's wrong. And they don't like that, right? Well, and you know what? Everybody has their struggles, so if they do this drug or that drug or get into this kind of behavior, it's wrong to say that it's wrong because it brings them pleasure, therefore it must be good. And as long as you don't inhibit on the pleasure of others, it should be perfectly okay. That is a hot mess. You got people dying left and right of drunk driving, people dying left and right of drug overdose. Why? Because they're chasing pleasure. My mom gave me a call today, and she described to me what is common for most workplaces. Nobody wants to be at work. Have you ever worked with somebody who doesn't like to work? Have you ever gone to work and you didn't want to be there? No doubt we all have. Maybe you woke up, you had a cold, you had a migraine, you had a headache, and you're like, I don't want to stay home today, right? Well, she clocked in, and everybody is just grumbling and complaining and whining, and I hate the company, and I hate this, and I hate that. Why have we developed this? Used to be you were glad to go to work. Now, obviously, there's always been lazy people, and obviously there are days we don't feel good, but if you make money an hour, you need those hours to make that money. And every hour that they're open, and that was the big complaint today, is that because they ran out of parts, a lot of people had to go home. Well, the way they put it is, got to go home. The way I put it is, had to go home. Because I can't make money from here. I want to make money there. So it's just a difference in philosophy there. Why do we fall into a society that is so work phobic, right? We don't want to go to work. We don't want to sweat at the brow. Why? Because we have taught them that pleasure is what's important. Think about all the sitcoms you've ever watched. Was work a big thing that they did? You almost never saw them at work, did you? I never got into that TV show Friends, but I heard something that my science teacher read one time a couple decades ago, but he read this about how it's important for you to realize that you've got to one day leave the coffee shop and actually go to work. And you think that is a big proponent of a lot of the funny TV shows that people watch. You're either not at work or you're getting back from work, and they never really focus on that, and that becomes indoctrinated and ingrained into people's minds that it's all about the pleasure. It's about being with my friends. It's about that 13th vacation that I'm going to take this year, right? Hedonism is all about that pleasure. I can do whatever I want. I can do it for as long as I want, and as long as I'm not hurting anybody, it's perfectly okay. The problem with that is it leads to people with some pretty wrecked lives. When we sit there, it used to be, it was very hush-hush when a woman had kids from four different men. It wasn't something you talked about often. At least if you did, it was in hushed tones. Now, it's the norm. You think about it, there's a lot of people kind of making money that way by getting pregnant from random people and making that money from the government. And it's a very sad reality. It's a very frightening thing. And what's turning around from that is, again, a weaker society, one that eschews work or discomfort, and one that really, it's really not as skilled as it used to be. And that kind of, that should break our hearts. We always talk about how the quality of things aren't what they used to be. Well, the craftsmen aren't what they used to be. Now it's no longer a matter of being able to think your way through a problem. It's regurgitating what you were taught on your training and pulling that back out. We don't have the handymen and the skilled workers in our country that we used to have. Now, another side effect is rationalism. Now, between nihilism and hedonism, rationalism is what weaves its way in between the other two to put them together in a pill that's easy enough for children and college kids and your common armchair philosopher to swallow. Rationalism dictates that what I understand and what I think about it is all that matters. You following me on this? So I can be a nihilist to a certain point, but it's my rationalism. Well, that doesn't seem very nice. That brings me back, right? Hedonism. Well, it's okay for me to get blackout drunk on the weekend, but it's good for me to at least not smell of booze on Tuesday morning. Right? Rationalism just kind of loops it all together. And that, in a nutshell, puts us where we are. Right, these Midianites, these Easterners that were getting together, they had weird philosophies, very much the same as what we had now, except instead of us worshiping ourselves, they had little stone gods to represent themselves. They at least pretended that it was something other than them that they were doing. But this uncertain enemy that is weak in all of its ways, right? A double-minded man is unstable. We see that it's also unsettled because of that. Now, as much as we are more and more accepting as a society of certain lifestyles, it's important for us to note that suicide rates are up 24% since 1999. Roughly around the time we started legalizing gay marriage. Roughly around the time we started pulling back on some of the restrictions on abortion. Roughly around the time we made major changes in the we'll call it health education system in the schools. Right? There was that little bubble window there while everyone was chanting about Y2K that major philosophical changes were made in the public school system. Right? So it's up. We're pushing bad philosophy and it's not working well. Think about this. I passed by a local used car dealership. Now, if I were to go and I were to buy a car from the used car dealership and I whip it around the road and everything's going well, I go about 10 miles down and it stalls. And I go and I go back to them. I say, I just take the car back, give me my money back, and I put a review out there online. Hey, listen, I bought this car. They gave me a really hard time. It didn't work. There we go. And then Brother Mark, he goes and he buys a used car from them, gets 10 miles down the road and stops and goes. And we all take a turn going to the used car shop. We all buy the car. We all go 10 miles. Following me? It'd be foolish to go back there to get one of those vehicles, right? They're doing something dirty. Well, as a society, we keep going back to the same vain philosophies. They're breaking down on people and they're still pushing it. It's almost like a cultural mandate to get into one of these broken philosophical vehicles and take it down the road. Humanism and social restructuring are not doing a good job at all. And as a matter of fact, as we see from this guy, they're not sleeping well at night either. You know what's been exploding over the last couple decades as well? Sleep aids, anxiety medications. All sorts of things to help you sleep. You ever take NyQuil because you couldn't sleep? Most people don't. Some people do. Now they got rid of the cough medicine part of it. Now you can just get some ZQuil and go straight to sleep. Hey, I'm not picking on you. If you've got ZQuil in your medicine cabinet, please don't go home and throw it away. But I'm kind of talking to a thing here where we've developed more things to help people sleep at night. Think of all the major technological advances that we have made have been more to comfort us at the end of the day than anything else. As a matter of fact, without those things, many people confess to increased anxiety, depression, frustration, shortened temper, because they don't have the sedation that's keeping them down. Well, so what's the plan here? How do we fight against a society that has become so off track? How do we be the child of God that we're supposed to, that light that brings them in? Well, let's take a look at the plan here that Gideon had. Now, Gideon's all excited, right? If we were to, where did I leave off? I'm in chapter 6. Verse 15 says, "And it was so when Gideon heard the telling of the dream and the interpretation thereof, that he worshipped and returned into the host of Israel and said, Arise, for the Lord hath delivered unto your hand the host of Midian." Now, I love this for Gideon. Every time God had told him to do something, well, get some fleece out. Lord, if it's your will, can we do this or do that? No, he came running back. All he needed was the one now. I mean, obviously you don't want to doubt a God that just shortened your army twice. He ran back. Listen, God has given us this victory. Here is what we're going to do. Verse 16, he divided the 300 men into three companies, and he put a trumpet in every man's hand with empty pitchers and lamps within the pitchers. And he said unto them, "Look on me and do likewise, and behold, when I come to the outside of the camp, it shall be that as I do, so shall ye do. When I blow with a trumpet, I and all that are with me, then blow ye the trumpets also on every side of the camp, and say the sword of the Lord and of Gideon." So Gideon and all the 100 men that were with him came unto the outside of the camp in the beginning of the middle watch. And they had but newly set the watch, and they blew the trumpets and brake the pitchers that were in their hands. So pulling this apart, what we need here. Now, when I have 300 people, swords are not the tool I need, because 300 swords are going to get covered in dust real fast. This is not going to be the battle to use swords. Now, we have watched this world use debating and arguing and power struggles and subterfuge and conquest to try to win their battles. We're not going to beat them by sheer numbers. Can we agree on that? We're not going to affect the society by waiting until we're big enough churches. It's just not the way it's going to work. We cannot do it the way the world does it. It's a broken system, and we ain't got the numbers for it. So what did they use? Well, the very first tool that they needed was light. And for us, when we equate the word light in the Bible, it means truth. It comes down to truth. We share the truth because we are commanded to, but it is also good for us to see, though, how badly needed the truth is in our society. This world needs to see that abortion is murder. They need to see that teaching over-sexualized material to children leads to issues. They need to see the reason why perversion should never be allowed in our society. They don't understand what is so wrong with it. And so many of God's people stand silent, either out of timidity or ignorance, or to the fake gospel of trying to be nice. Right? We can't tell people that they're wrong. It's the 11th gospel. Or it's the 11th commandment. Thou shalt not tell anybody they're wrong. You can. As a matter of fact, God commands that we do that. Now, it doesn't have to be ugly. It doesn't have to be mean. But it does have to be. You have to say it. Right? Well, you know, teach his own. And all the polite things that we try to say. Can I tell you this? If we were to try to negotiate people into this church, the Bible would look a whole lot different. You understand? If God was trying to get us to door-to-door salesmen people into this building, the scriptures would say more things. There would be more sales philosophy in here. What's in the Bible? What does the Bible give us? The gospel. It gives us the truth. If I can't get you in with the truth, I can't get you in. Right? And I've often said that about our philosophy and how we do certain things, why I'm against certain things in the church as far as programs go. You know what? If we were having a great big carnival and we wanted to rent a bouncy house just for our kids, that's perfectly okay. But for whatever reason, I'm against bouncy house Sundays where we cut halfway through Sunday school and let the kids go out and bounce. I'm against that kind of idea. Why? Because what's that doing? It's trying to say, hey, this is what the gospel is. It's having a good time at church. That's not it. I love having a good time at church. You love having a good time at church? I love on Thursdays, we're out there playing with the kids, we're roughhousing. I love that. But that is not the gospel. That's fun. And some people said this, well, you can have fun after church. Well, you know what? Why can't I have fun with God's people? Why can't I have fun in God's house? Why can't I enjoy that sort of thing? It's much better than us sitting there saying, oh, as a church, we don't accept fun. Go out and find it in this world. You follow me on that second part? Go out and find it in this world. You can do it outside of the church. Well, who do you think they're going to go do it with? Right. So again, we want the truth to be the mainstay of what we're talking about. I cannot dull the doctrine the Bible gives us to make people more comfortable and slowly ease them into it. I was sitting one time and I didn't quite understand this principle. We had visitors. And as I saw my pastor come up, I knew what we were preaching on. Pastor Hugan, he's a big fan of series preaching. I'm not all that good at it, but he's a big fan of series preaching. And I knew what we were about to talk about. And I sat there probably more nervous for what pastor was going to say than the person sitting in the back. And that's folly. That's foolishness. What would I be expecting? Would I be expecting for the pastor to slowly dole out the truth? Now, again, there's a difference between teaching and slapping, right? If someone comes in and they've got some rainbow hair and they've got some kind of shirt that identifies them with one of the gender classes out there, and the very first thing I do is come up here and just start jackhammering on this pulpit and just insulting them, I understand. But to sit there and tell them, well, you know, teach his own until the Lord saves them and brings them in and softens their heart and then they can understand it. You're lying to them. And there'll come a moment where they realize that you hid something from them. It's better just to tell the truth. And you know what? We can't get caught up in the devil's idea that if we don't play soft and nice with people, they'll never come to the Lord. That's why the doctrine of election is such an important thing. Because if the Lord's going to save them, the Lord's going to save them. Well, if I don't, they'll never be saved. God has not lost a bit of His saving power. That blood that Jesus shed has not become less effective over the years. If the Lord knocks a heart down, He doesn't care what color the hair is. He doesn't care how long they've been a sodomite. The Lord doesn't care. He'll knock that heart down and change that person. We need to hold fast by the truth. We get to the point in many churches you can't preach on sin because it hurts people's feelings. You can't push for revival because it leads to people thinking we're doing something wrong. It used to be that you would have a handful of people in an institution or city that weighed us down because you had to stop and acknowledge their feelings before anything can get done. Now we have a solid majority of people who are both emotionally and mentally feeble. It is good to be comforted. It is nice to have a compliment every now and then, but to need it to exist or to move properly is foolishness to its core. We have this philosophy in management. It was called the sandwich theory. And it's in order for me to correct anybody's behavior, I needed to first compliment them. Caspian, your hair looks great. Yeah, great hair today, buddy. I'm going to need you to stop wiggling in your pew. Also, I love how you tied your shoes. Compliment, correction, compliment. It works great in kindergarten. But it's a philosophy they're using for adults now. Why? Because, well, as Paul says, we're drinking milk when we ought to be eating meat. Right? As the society that we've created, where almost everybody, well, I can't because nobody told me I look nice today. Get over it. I had a person ask if they could go home one time because they didn't like the way their hair came out. Now, let that sink in for a second. Now, I'm looking at them, and I get it. I'm a man. I don't understand certain things. I wake up in the morning, and I go like this, and if it's still there and it falls right, I'm happy. As long as I don't wake up with that mashed potato head I'm worried about. Right? Brother Art looks good. Brother Gene looks good. I do it. It's not going to be great. It's like somebody deflated a basketball. It's what it's going to be. I got a Charlie Brown head. I'm in trouble. Stay. So I didn't get it. And I just kind of looked over at her and I told her, I go, there's nothing in the handbook that allows me to let you go home because you're not having a good hair day. And I tried. You see how professional I tried to make that sound? I didn't say no. I didn't agree with the bet. I can't. There's nothing in there that says that I can. I'm sorry. Tears. Tears into the manager's office. I got called into the manager's office. Right? And the lady laughed because the property manager, having no idea what to say, just let her go. And then later in the week, we did finally let her go. But I'm sitting there. She goes, Matt. I go, yeah? She goes, I heard what you said, and I've got no idea how to correct you, but I fear that she's going to escalate it if we don't sit here for at least 5 minutes. So she went back to her work, and I just kind of grabbed some files and started filing things while I waited for it to be a long enough time to make it seem like I was being chastened. I had no idea what else to do. It's all about how people feel. You got to make me feel good. You can't tell me I'm wrong. That's adulthood. Tell me I'm wrong. If you don't tell me I'm wrong, I don't know what's going to happen. Danielle every now and then take a look at me, and she'll say, hey, fix this one part about your clothing. Right? And I'll let you guess what that one part of my clothing that needs to be fixed is. If she doesn't, what happens? I don't need her to say, hey, hon, you did everything right with the way you dressed today. I just want to let you know you need to fix this. That's not how it goes. Hey, fix this. Tell me. Don't make me feel good when I shouldn't feel good. Right? Tell me the truth. And that's what we need in this world. We need to tell them what sin is. We need to tell them how to get right. They need the unreserved, unfiltered, unapologetic, unaltered truth. Fact of the matter is, they need to hear that you are a sinner. And as a sinner, we deserve an eternity in hell. Jesus, in his love and mercy, came and died on a cross for that sin, to pay that debt that you owe. That by believing and repenting of our sin, we can have eternal life. That what we do matters, that it is possible to live a life that pleases God, that we can have things like peace and comfort, but not from self-worshipping and pill-popping and bottle-drinking, but by following the directions and commands of a thrice-holy God. They need the truth. And I think also what we need in this world is a lot more direction. Gideon came forward all excited and said, listen, this is what we're going to do. There needs to be a plan. And there needs to be some warnings as to what's going on. Gideon made it very clear. Hey, listen, we're going to split up. I'm going to 100 over here, 100 and me over here, 100 over here. And we're going to take these things with you. And whatever you see me doing, you do. When I blow the trumpet, you blow the trumpet. When I smash the pot, you smash the pot. When I yell, you yell. These are the words we're going to yell. This world needs direction. This world could use a whole lot more direction. No one seems to know how to do anything anymore. You go out driving and you see things. You see how people dress and it makes you want to have a conversation with their parents. Am I alone on that? Anybody else want to get people's parents' phone numbers? See these? They got little cows and stars on them. Those are pajamas. This is a bank. Pajamas, bed. Pants, bank. Pajamas, bed. You try. Right? See this? I know you're comfortable, but this is underwear. Right? This goes under the clothes. Not what you wear while you're shopping at Walmart for clothes. I want to stop and explain things to people. These guys up here just interrupted my day, something fierce today. It must have been, somebody got paid and bought tires because they were burning tires all day over here. Up the road, down the road. This one guy came out, he was in a Dodge Charger, gray thing, just was squawking it so bad I got up. And I had to go see what was going on. And sure enough, he was just grinding those tires out on the asphalt. If you go over there, you'll see it. And he goes, rawr! Squeals down the road, squeals back up the road. As he's coming around here, I'm out there at the window, and I pop the side window open just to see an enormous car-sized dent on the side of it. And I just kind of sit there and I go, you know what, I wanted to be dad for a second. I know I can't be the whole town's pastor, but I wanted to be his dad for a second. Just come here. You see the boo-boo? This thing you're doing causes them, okay? Go open up your bank app. Let me see. You see no money? Tires cost money. I want to give direction to the world. And you know what? This world needs God's direction. It needs to be told what to do, what not to do. And in a way, by giving that direction, we disrupt much of what's going on. Much like this world, the Midianites, they had a plan. We're going to go to bed. We're going to eat some breakfast. We're going to go to war. And this was supposed to be a little war. No doubt the Midianite scouts had come back and said, hey, listen, I don't know what happened. We saw 32,000 people yesterday. Like 20,000 of them bailed. We have no idea. All that's left is some dust. They all went home. I don't know what happened, but they're, and everybody in the Midianite army is going, all right. And then the scouts come back and say, hey, listen, I really don't know what's happening now, but all that's left is 300. You just saw a bunch of people. They got some water, got up and went home. I don't know what happened. And they're sitting there going, all right, we got 300 people over there. We're going to get up. We're going to squash these guys and go on and take the rest of this, take the rest of the country. That's what we're going to do. They had a plan. This world has a plan. We're going to continue to pollute people. We're going to give them slavery into sin and call it freedom. We're going to educate the children this way. We're going to form all of the media content, all of the entertainment, to kind of create this kind of a mindset in this world. And there's nothing that these few Christians can do about it. Well, the problem with their philosophy is there's not a few of us. There are many. There really are. If you look at hardline true Baptists, there are many. And I'll tell you what, we can disrupt them by just a handful of God's people behaving in obedience to their master. Amen. See, well, the very first thing they did to disrupt them is he woke them up. The devil takes great joy in seeing mankind asleep. He loves that. Too consumed to hear the gospel, too sleepy to go to work. And you know what's that? You know that's what the devil really wants, is to get us pathetic, get us tired. I'd read, but I'm too tired. I'd research what I hear and see on the screen, but you know what? I just gotta go to bed. I'd go to work, but I'm too tired, too stressed out, too blah, 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 blah. All the excuses we have. Right, we were sitting there one day, we were working together on something, and I'm looking over and they're on their phone, and I'm doing work, and I look over and they're on their phone, and I'm doing work, and we all had projects that we were set to do, right, and we were going to come together at 3 o'clock. Well, 3 o'clock came together, and guess who didn't have their stuff done? Miss, I'm on the phone the whole day. Come together, you know why she said she didn't get any of the work done? I'm really tired from last night, guys. Not tired enough to go like this with your thumb. It's like this didn't bother you. I saw this and I saw that. You weren't too tired to run to the store during your lunch break, but you were too tired during work doing all this things. So I went to the boss and I tattled. I'm a tattletale. I tattled. Wake up. I'm too tired. I gotta get a little bit tougher. Put a little bit more effort into it. And you know what? In many ways, we need to wake them up from this dreamscape of a philosophy that the world is pushing. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 34 says, awake to righteousness and sin not, for some have not the knowledge of God. I speak this to your shame. Well, how am I supposed to obey? I don't know. Everyone's got the book. God holds us all accountable for this. Whether you're lost or saved, whether you've ever stepped foot into a church, God holds you responsible for what He set down. You know what? In many ways, this scared them. I mean, think about this for a second. I don't have a way to show you a picture of the terrain in which I think this took place there out in that wilderness, but the way it's set up is he's in front of the camp. They're along the sides of the camp. They're shouting. There's lights. There's trumpets. All this stuff is going on, and it scares them. You know what? Real religion, the truth, scares the lost soul. What if I'm wrong? What if I really am a sinner? What if what I do matters? See, a large part of what they fight against, you know, otherwise they just sit there silently and ignore us. The only reason why they fight against us is because they're afraid we're right. Amen. They are. Because there's so much that makes sense. There's so much that they can't explain. So much that they know to be true. But it doesn't jive with their hedonistic, nihilistic, their own self-thinking kind of way. It doesn't make sense in that. So they deny it. They push it away. In many ways, these men were scared as they blew the trumpets and they shouted in. Everyone was scared. Verse 21 says, and they stood every man in his place around the camp, and all the host ran and cried and fled. And the 300 blew the trumpets, and the Lord set every man's sword against his fellow, even throughout all the host, and the host fled to Beth Bathshadab and Sarahareth, and to the border of Abimaholah, unto Tabith. And the men of Israel gathered themselves together out of Naphtali, and out of Asher, and out of Manasseh, and pursued after the Midianites. Completely terrified them. Now, try to think about this from their perspective. You're in the tent. Tomorrow, breakfast and victory. That's what's on the schedule. Breakfast, victory. We're good. There's 300 people over there. They couldn't get past the main guard we set up. And all of a sudden, now this transition in the watch, it's important to pay attention to, right? Because you've got some people late to the watch. You've got some people who have already left the watch. It's the perfect time, right? It's that wonderful window where the new cops are still getting their breakfast and their snacks and their orders for the day, and the lazy cops have already headed back into the depot to do paperwork. And as a matter of fact, they have done studies on this, that some criminals are clever that way, and that they try to time it exactly in that window. Well, they found that window. So you're a guard. You're headed back to your bed. You're ready to go to sleep. You're a new guard. You just woke up and you're coming back out. And all of a sudden, here's all these trumpet blasts. Or you're from another watch and you've been sleeping for a while. All these people, they're getting up. They're putting their pants back on. Where's my sword? That's your sword. What's going on? And they're blind and they're all torn up and they're all discombobulated. And you come out and all you see and hear is light and shouting and trumpets, and because it's so percussive and so close to you, you think you're being overwhelmed. The 32,000 came back. We're surrounded. This is not great. And all you see is another discombobulated person in the dark swinging a sword. And the Lord set them against each other. Because all they saw was enemies everywhere. They were so confused and so messed up from the shock that they started fighting each other. You know what often happens when given the truth? The world wants to fight and they don't necessarily care who they're fighting. They'll fight the moderates, they'll fight the aggressives, they'll fight anybody just to prove that they are right, just to protect themselves. So that they can again have what Francis Schaeffer talked about, that personal peace and affluency. My stuff and my way. We see here a blasting of the trumpet. A trumpet is a type. It's a type of celebration and praise, but it's also a type of warning. We saw that in Jericho, right? The sound of the trumpet, warning that judgment is about to happen. If we skip ahead to the book of Revelation, it's another warning before a certain thing is opened up, before a new catastrophe is released onto the earth. This trumpet was blasted out. Folks, we need to daily call out that trumpet that, hey, listen, there is doom coming. And what you're doing is you're putting yourself on the opposite side of the winner. God's going to win this. Oh, and they'll laugh and they'll poo-poo and well, there's no God. And then they'll go on and on and on. But just kind of look at them and say, well, you'll see. Right? If we were to present this whole idea to the people that were camping, they would have laughed. Those 300 people are going to get you to kill your own selves. Like, they're not even going to draw a sword. And we're going to win. And you know what? Go to the book of Revelation. We're going to win. And we're not going to draw a single sword. Oh, we'll have them. I think we'll be all drawn up. I mean, we'll look the part. But with a single word, God's going to bring it all down. Jesus Christ is going to bring it all down on them. And they need to be weary of that. They need to be aware of that. They can look at you like you're crazy, but they will remember one day the words that you said. You know what? God gives the victory. When does God give us the victory? Well, when we're where we should be and we're doing what we should be doing. Too many churches refuse to do the work. They don't teach the people. They don't give the gospel. Right? They'll go their whole week without mentioning the name of Jesus Christ once. They'll only talk about Jesus when they get into the confines of the church. They won't invite a single person. You know what drives me crazy? Can I be honest about this? I don't want to hurt any feelings here if it's been done here before. I don't like the idea of a friend day. You ever hear about those? Baptist churches really got into this where they had a friend day. It was a day designated for you to bring your friend. Can I just tell you this? Every day is friend day at Home Baptist Church. Every day is friend day. Every day is cousin day. You got a weird aunt? Every day is weird aunt day. Like, oh, no, it's good because we have a dinner and we do this and we do that. Great, but how do I get my weird cousin into the church when we don't have fried chicken? Right? Invite them anyway. They would talk about, well, I've been waiting. We've been planning this for a month. How do you plan on inviting a friend for a whole month? There better be cake and like doves flying out of the cake to invite them if you're taking a whole month. No, do what you've got to do. Be where you need to be. And I thought about that at my mom's work. These people there, they are so miserable. They're so unhappy. And I know that it bothers my mom a little bit, but you know what my first thought was? Oh, well, they need you. God, don't make mistakes. They need you. Now listen, if it's really rough and you get the opportunity to get out, but they need you. Don't get out until you've given what you're supposed to give. Right? You ever find yourself around ornery and nasty people? Guess what? They need you. Now, many of them, they might cause a fuss. They might get upset at it. But you know what? You need to fight the fight while you're there. Well, I'm the only one there. You know what? The Lord's really good at using low numbers. As a matter of fact, it seems to be his favorite thing to do to us. Low numbers. Why? Because it proves who he is. You're not going in there alone. You're going with the Lord. You know what? This person told me never to give him the gospel again. Well, the Lord's going to go with you when you go to give him the gospel again. It doesn't matter. At least not to him. And you know what? While we're given the gospel, it's important for us to also do what we can do to disrupt what the enemy is doing. I'm not going to allow that philosophy into my house. Many of us that homeschool, that's the purpose of it. All right, we're trying to protect our kids from some of the philosophies that this world does. Many people, they seek Christian schools just to find out that the Christian schools aren't really all that Christian. Right? It's kind of a bummer nowadays to see that. Right? There was one that we could have potentially sent our kids to down in Allen Park, just south of Detroit. But they gave up the King James Bible. They gave up a lot of Christian philosophies. They were already Arminian, but they went super Arminian on it, where, you know, it's all about making decisions and it's all about how much you can give. Completely fell off. It breaks your heart. Right? I don't allow those things into my home. I'm protective over what happens on the TV. I'm protective over what they read. At least I try to be. I don't allow that stuff in my life either. Right? So many people are quick to put protections to stop things from coming into others, and then they turn those protections off when it's them. Well, if it's good for the goose, it's good for the gander. Right? If it's good for everybody else, it's good for you too. Well, I don't have kids. I don't have to be protective. You are a steward of your heart, mind, and body. Protect it. Do good with it. I'm not a great swimmer, but I'm a fairly good swimmer. And I availed myself to the Cass River, took my kayak out on it. Oh, it was so beautiful. Saw a beautiful eagle flying down. And I came in and Brother Tim told me the most horrifying thing that I thought of. He goes, you know, it's really good when the river's like that because it's not too deep. I go, oh no, how deep is it? You know, I'm a fairly decent swimmer. I've kayaked quite a number of times. I've roughed that thing up a little bit. But you know what I still put on when I went out there? A life vest. Because I'm not so sure of myself, I'm stupid. Can I say that? Right? I don't know if I told you this, I saw a person one time, no helmet on, riding a motorcycle, but they had a mask. Not a bug mask, a KN95 we put on when we go to the grocery store mask. They didn't want to catch COVID, but gravel to the brain is okay. I'm not so good, I'm stupid. And that's a good philosophy for us to have. Oh, well, you know what, I'm stronger than that. Don't be so strong, you get dumb. And that's what we see people do that. One of my first jobs that I had, we were pulling a roof off of a house. I was trying to save up money to go to driver's training. And I was working under the table for my uncle, incredibly illegally for a 14 or 15-year-old to do. But anyway, my boss, this loudmouth guy who's done it all, seen it all, knows it all, decided that how he was going to remove a chimney off of the side of a house was he was going to kick it. Well, he kicked it and it didn't work. So he kicked it again and it didn't work. So you know what you need when it doesn't work? You need a flying kick to the chimney. he rode that bad boy down two stories. Went to the hospital, had a broke up shoulder, had a broke up back. He was out for like a good 2 months before he could come back to us in any capacity. A few months down the road, after I'd gone back to school, I'd found out that he lost his hand entirely because they were building a pole barn, and he was using one of those things to raise it up and put it down. He wasn't being careful with where he put his hand. The strap that was holding the thing came loose and took his hand with it. He was the best, if you hear him talk about it. And you know what? He was the best. He was pretty good. He could do things with a nailer. He could lift heavy objects. He was the best. The problem was, he was so good, he was dumb. And many of us, well, I can watch that, and I can listen to that, and I can do this, and I can be there. I'm strong enough. No, you're not. Because oftentimes when somebody makes an oops, it's the good people that make the oops. It is. We were talking about the Olympics. You always see people, they go into these Olympic things, and they make a huge mistake, and it breaks your heart, doesn't it? You think they put years of their lives, some of them a decade of their lives, into training for this event, and they make a mistake. You want to know why you so often see professionals make a mistake? Because they do it so often. More times you do it, the more opportunity you have for a mistake. And you know what? If you sit there and you're playing around with stuff you're not supposed to be playing around with, you can't be surprised when you're losing the battle. All right, well, I'm going to go give so-and-so the gospel. You were just out drinking with us last week. Well, no, listen, you can't talk like that. Well, we could talk like that last week when you told the joke. We find that we're failing in the battle because we're so good we don't think we can fail. Folks, that's a lie. We don't fight the way this world fights, and we ought to fight the way God tells us to do it, and we ought to fight well. Gideon walked away with the victory. And the final point here, and I kind of skipped by it, but I don't want to completely abandon it, is at a particular point, everybody jumped in on this battle and chased them down. It was a beautiful thing. You know what? On my own, I can battle this much. And on your own, you can battle this much. And when we put it all together, we've got a great big web, don't we? We do. You know what? I'll tell you the truth. You and I, we could do this as a church. We could get together and we can knock on every door in Mount Morris and maybe get 2 or 3 people to show up. You know that exponentially we'll do better in our own personal lives? That while we are compelled to make an organized effort to go out and reach this world, if we don't do it on a personal basis, we're failing. That's truth. If I'm not making a personal effort in giving the gospel, I'm failing in this. Right? The Great Commission is the first thing we do. Right? Let's not fail. Let's battle well and battle hard. Heavenly Father,